Hello and welcome to the Chengdu Gaming Federation podcast. My name is Charlie and I'm joined here by a guest who joined me on a recent podcast named Ryan, where we spoke about the development of his independent game, which is titled Carrier Commander. In the most recent podcast, we talked about a subject which we wanted to get in a little bit more deeply today, which is artificial intelligence in games. What's up? Welcome.
Yeah, I'm glad to be back. I'm almost a regular or co-host on this podcast at this point.
I think you are. I mean, we've been going down an interesting road of independent development discussions, and you're a perfect guest to talk about that with, since you've been embarking on this now 2+ year journey to develop your first independent game. And you've learned so much through this process, and you've also done such a good job chronicling a lot of the things you've been going through on your blog, which I understand you just got a domain for, so that's great.
Yeah, thanks. That was your idea. From GameToBrain.com.
From GameToBrain.com.
I just feel so much more real now that it's not .blogspot.com.
You're legit. You're there.
Yeah, I wanted to start off with a little tidbit, a little interesting thing I learned on my AI kind of research journey, and that is the AI of Pac-Man. Basically, every single level of Pac-Man has the same AI. I think most people don't realize that this classic game has such a simple AI that just ended up being one of the most classic games of all time. So in Pac-Man...
When you say AI in Pac-Man, by the way, just to clarify, you mean the movement of the ghosts? Is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, the ghosts, right. The enemy characters. So in Pac-Man, there are three ghosts?
Sounds right.
One ghost always turns left. One ghost always turns right. One ghost always turns a random direction. And the last ghost always turns towards the player.
Oh, wow.
So a simple rule set like this... And let's say there was only one ghost. The player would figure out very quickly that one ghost always turned left, right?
Right.
But because you have all these different ghosts and each by a different rule set in the play space, the player never really... I mean, decades of people playing Pac-Man, and I've never heard anybody mention this.
I've never heard that either.
You don't notice it when you're playing the game, but the ghosts all follow a very predictable cycle. And there's only one of them that's actually... reacting to your input as the player, smart ghost.
That's really fascinating. That's a good example of what we were talking about recently, which was kind of in the discussion which led up to this podcast, which was the behavioral tree, which is programming different paths of behavior for artificial intelligence. And in our discussion, we talked about how many of the nodes which are on this tree, which compose the behavioral movement of the characters, are very simple. So like the ones you just described for a ghost which always turns left or always turns right, I mean, it's so simple. It's not going to fool anybody. But if you include other behavioral modes within that, then it can become difficult enough to understand that you can't decipher it, that it creates the illusion of being intelligent.
Right, yeah. Kind of simulated complexity by just having a lot of entities.
Do you think that high-level Pac-Man players are identifying which is the ghost which turns left, which was the one that turns right, and they're just focusing on other ones? Or I wonder if that becomes part of the high-level strategy.
They must.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's only one ghost that you really, really need to worry about.
Right.
The smart ghost.
Right. That'd be a good game name or blog name, the smart ghost.
The smart ghost.
A game AI podcast.
You know, I think the Pac-Man example, it brings up a lot of interesting points about AI. One of the first things I learned programming AI for my strategy game was that game AI needs to be fun. That's the most important part. It doesn't need to be realistic. It doesn't need to be smart. The most important thing is that it's fun. Can you imagine if all four ghosts were a smart ghost? They would annihilate you.
Sure.
Yeah. So making the AI just a little bit dumber makes the game more accessible to players.
It also makes it so easy to program. I mean, there's really only one ghost that you are really programming, right? I mean, the others are just kind of going on autopilot.
Right, right. There's only one reactionary ghost. So I think AI, game AI, should be fun. It's probably the most important thing that we can say on this podcast. It's kind of the foundation for all game AI design. And to bring that up, you probably also need to make a distinction between AI and gaming AI because they're very different.
Yeah, sure. I looked up the definition of artificial intelligence just so we could start with a clear understanding of what exactly that is.
Yeah, sure.
Artificial intelligence is an area of computer science that emphasizes the creation of intelligent machines that work and react like humans. Some of the activities computers with artificial intelligence are designed for include speech recognition, learning, planning, and problem solving. And there's a really lengthy Wikipedia article on artificial intelligence, as you would expect. But what I didn't expect is that there's a very lengthy article on artificial intelligence in video games.
Right. And they're different articles, right? Because
totally different.
Game AI is not AI. They're different.
Yeah, it's fascinating that artificial intelligence in video games is not a subcategory of artificial intelligence. It's its own field of Wikipedia, at least.
Yeah. And we'll discuss a lot of the differences later. But once again, the most important part of a game AI is that it's fun. And that's probably the most important distinction.
One of the things which you mentioned, which is interesting, is that the objective of AI is not to be intelligent or to respond exactly like a human. And some have argued, I learned this just not long ago, that some specifically within the field of artificial intelligence argue that game AI is not actually artificial intelligence. It's just an advertising buzzword used to describe computer programs that are using simple sorting and matching algorithms to create the illusion of intelligent behavior.
Yeah, you know, the term AI for gaming, when did that come about? The 80s, 90s, at a time when real AI was not very advanced.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think maybe around the time of Pac-Man, like 1970s, something like that. Although in the historical section of the artificial intelligence in video games article, it mentions how the real inception is the 1950s, which is sort of the very, very beginning of games. But I guess it really comes back to what is artificial intelligence in games exactly? Is it just programming a simple path to create this illusion? Does that qualify as artificial intelligence? There may be some area open to interpretation there.
Yeah, I would like to offer an altered definition of gaming AI is that it's not trying to simulate intelligence as much as it's trying to simulate players. It's trying to simulate the experience of playing with other players.
Mm-hmm.
So talking about the specifics of AI, I wanted to just kind of break down some of the fundamentals of designing game AI. How that works in different games.
Let's start with Carrier Commander, because we talked about this at pretty great length in the last podcast, which we recorded. And in that one, you mentioned AI was one of the areas where you didn't foresee as much work as you actually had to do. So you were kind of in a situation where that was sort of, as I understand it, one of the most difficult challenges which you faced in the development of Carrier Commander. And can you describe what that problem was like or what you thought about artificial intelligence before you got into that development project, and sort of what would you describe that experience as?
Sure. In Carrier Commander, which is a strategy game, so it's using kind of an advanced AI, not something you'd find in like Pac-Man. As the level, each level, there's 21 levels. Each level has its own custom AI. And from the beginning to the end, is it kind of walks you through my journey of learning how to make AI as a developer. Because the beginning stages, the AI is very simple. It's either pattern based, and then you know a little bit later on, it's a little bit reactionary, where I say if the player does this, then do this. And then towards the end of the game, as I gained more experience and I had more scripts for the AI, it increased in complexity. And by the end of the game, the computer is making strategic decisions based on decision maps and these grids that calculate kind of like the point value of each location on the map. So the AI in my game advances as you play through it, and kind of walks all the way from very beginning level AI to probably what a game strategy game developer would consider like just a medium. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a first time developer. There's no like advanced learning algorithms or anything like that.
At the most complex stage, what does the grid look like? Is it very complex? Is it large? How lengthy is it?
So the grid is the size of the play space, and my game is conveniently kind of grid oriented, like a board game.
Mm-hmm.
And so a big thing in Carrier Commander is about the gun coverage. So different ships have different guns, and you know the guns can shoot different distances. So an ideal positioning for your ship would be a place where your ship can shoot the most other ships while receiving the least fire itself. So the decision map in Carrier Commander takes every ship on the screen and it assigns it a value based on, is it about to die? How valuable of a ship is it? Does it have good guns on it? And then from that value, it also does another grid. There's like four grids it combines. So one is the value of the targets. The second grid is the threat level. So if I move to this square, how many ships will be shooting at me and how much damage will I take? And a third grid is the ship's ability to take out valuable targets.
Mm-hmm.
So it combines all these grids and it forms a fourth grid that just gives a point score for every single spot on the map for each ship. And from there, the computer can decide where's the best place to move the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just for the ship movements. There's actually in the game, there's another mechanic of drawing a path for your airplanes from one carrier to the other. And that one's actually based on simple pathfinding. So it looks at the coverage of anti-air guns and it tries to draw a path around it or through the least amount of air coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's the AI in my game.
How'd you get to the point where you end up with four grids, though? So you're making the game, you have the concept for the game, you understand how the ships move, how the ships fire, and so on. You get to this problem. What does it look like coming to the solution of these four grids? How'd you learn to do that? Where'd you learn to implement this?
There is a fantastic article by Intel on artificial intelligence, which really completely educated me on AI, and I'll link to it below so anyone can read it. And the section in the third part of the article is on decision maps. So I researched decision maps, and decision maps are a great way to kind of give your AI entity working information that it can use as a computer that you can program to make decisions. So obviously the way a computer thinks and the way a person thinks are different. But one of the best ways you can emulate human decision-making is with these decision maps. So through research, I tried a few things that we're going to talk about later, like finite state machines. And the thing that worked out best for a strategy game, and I ended up using the later levels, was these kind of grid-based decision maps. And you asked what they look like. So in the debugging mode, I would actually have an overlay of all the point values of the tiles. And it just, to see the game like the computer sees it, it's like an Excel spreadsheet with a bunch of numbers on it.
Sure. Right?
And then it chooses the highest numbered cell.
Right. That's pretty interesting. How much time do you think it took you to develop this solution for the AI? So you make it for one stage, you realize you got to make it for the next. I mean, if you can approximate like ballpark figure, how much of the game development or programming time went into just creating the AI?
Maybe 10 to 20%
Okay.
of the time. Because it's a strategy game that's the size of a mobile screen, the variety of the levels has to come from the computer using different strategies every time. Because it can't come from like really unique levels in such a limited space. So I really tried to approach each and every level as its own separate AI. Sometimes I'd pre-program strategies in, which worked out well. But by the end of the game, because of the kind of branching possibilities that both you and the computer could take, you have to program a more dynamic AI without pre-constructed decisions. It mm-hmm. has to make its own decisions because as a developer, you have no idea what it's going to look like at the end if you have all these branching possibilities in your game.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. Also, one thing which came to mind is that I know your game has a hard mode. Is the difference between normal and hard mode chiefly in the way that the AI responds to your activity, or are there other factors?
No, the hard mode is the original normal mode. And I figured out that normal mode was too difficult for people. So I made easy mode where I just nerfed the computer for everything.
I see.
So the hard mode is actually just fair.
Okay, I see.
And that kind of brings me to one of the first things I learned. I think you taught me this over WeChat because I bragged one day. I said, hey guys, I wrote this AI level on my game and it beat me and I'm so proud of my AI. And your comment was, yeah, but is it fun? And I was like, well, it's not really that fun to get beat by this master AI that just smashes me.
Sure. You know, it reminds me of StarCraft. If you play against a StarCraft AI, it can be extremely difficult, but just not that much fun. As it turns out, the StarCraft AI is actually cheating. So that may be one of the reasons why it doesn't feel like a fair fight.
Oh, it must be cheating because of its has access to information that is covered by Fog of War.
Precisely. That's exactly right. Yeah, and in StarCraft 2, they've corrected that situation so that now differing AI difficulty levels don't have that kind of access. So the AI does respond more like a human player. And it actually responds so much like a human player that they've had like world champion StarCraft players play against this AI under heavily scrutinized conditions. Mm-hmm. And the AI wins, which is not a shock. But AI has come a long way. I think StarCraft's a good example because your game's a real-time strategy game, an offline game. StarCraft, although it has an online mode, obviously it's also an offline real-time strategy game. So it has a lot of similar elements in terms of the way that enemy, you know, ships and creatures respond to your activity.
Yeah, right. And, you know, are we talking about a real AI or the game AI? Because nowadays they're programming real AI to play games, which is super cool.
Exactly. I think that's the difference. I mean, I'm not really that familiar with, you know, how the AI has evolved through StarCraft 1 to StarCraft 2, because there's about, you know, 15 years between those two games. And when the original StarCraft came out, which I think was 1998, obviously artificial intelligence was not really much of a buzzword at that time. That was so long ago. I mean, that was sort of before the, you know, dot-com boom and bust. So quite a long time ago, but I know that StarCraft II now possesses some very, very advanced AI. And unfortunately, it has not lent much to the mainstream success of that game. But it is very complex from a strategy game perspective. So much so that it's a legitimate area of academic study.
What are some of your favorite AI you've encountered in games?
You know, I was thinking about this question when you asked me this yesterday, and I think you answered the question for me. I think that the most interesting example of AI in games which I've ever played was in the monolith title Shadow of Mordor, which is a game which takes place in the Lord of the Rings universe. I played it a couple years ago, came out on PlayStation 3 and then on PlayStation 4 also. And the best part of the game, by far, in my opinion, is what the developers called the Nemesis system. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with Monolith, but they have like a very long history of developing some really top class AAA games. And they apparently consider themselves to be experts in the field of artificial intelligence.
Cool.
Yeah. And they wanted to push artificial intelligence in their game to a level which it had never been to before. And the way in which they did this, I think, really underscores the point which you make about artificial intelligence has to be fun before it's intelligent necessarily. And what their system does is sort of dynamically creates personalities, really believable, plausible personalities for computer-controlled NPCs in such a way that it very convincingly feels like you're playing against actual people with backgrounds and emotional content, and you really feel that they respond to you in the way that real people would. And it makes the game feel very dynamic, and kind of other games feel a little bit flat in comparison. When you're playing against NPC characters who are talking to you and reacting to what you're doing, in most games, it doesn't feel anything like a real person because they're sort of built with a script and they're acting in a predictable way, and it sort of unfolds in a sort of flat fashion. And the Nemesis system completely breaks that paradigm. So basically, you are hunting a number of these sort of orcs, and they all have names and personalities. They have accents. They have different physical mannerisms. The way in which they talk to you is all different. It's all very unique. And you're hunting these guys down, and you may encounter them on the battlefield. They see you. They address you. You have a dialogue with them. It's different every time. They must have recorded thousands of different verbal snippets, and they're, you know, combined in such a way that it just feels very lifelike. And what I noticed in particular, and a lot of reviewers and journalists took note of this as well, and it was considered one of the best games of the year when it came out, which I think was 2015 or so, is that when you're playing the game, if you encounter one of these AI-controlled characters and he kills you, then he's sort of taunting you, and he's gloating, and he's over your dead body, and he's like calling you names and making fun of you. And then you respawn, and then you encounter this same character again, and he responds to the previous situation which you had. So there's sort of a context for your relationship with these characters. So he says, you know, I killed you last time. You want me to kill you again? And like, you fight him again. Maybe he kills you again. And he's like, I'll come back a third time. I'll kill you a third time. And they respond in intelligent ways like that. And so you really feel some sort of grit about, you know, I know this guy. It just, you can feel it in your mouth. Like, I really just want to kill this guy. And it's very rare that I have felt that feeling of emotional reaction to computer controlled characters.
You know, that kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier with game AI should be a simulated player. Because you'll notice you like that game not because the enemies are so intelligent and they're predicting your every move and beating you. You like it because they're relatable like people. It feels like you're playing with people.
Yeah.
That's a great example.
Another really interesting twist on this is that as you are, you're engaged in sort of rivalries with some of these characters. Like, some of the most difficult ones will kill you repeatedly. And in some cases, you kill them repeatedly as well. When you kill them, your character will like taunt them. And then later they'll come back and they'll be like, thought you killed me before, I'm back again. You know, and it's like a growing rivalry. And one interesting twist on this is that if you have other players who are playing Shadow of Mordor, then they can confront the characters who have bullied you in the game or vice versa.
Wow.
Like, I can encounter a character and it'll say, Ryan was killed by this guy like four times. And if I can defeat him, then both of us will get a bonus. And it sort of creates this social network effect with these artificial, you know, characters, which feel very lifelike.
But are randomly generated, right? They're not scripted characters.
That's correct. And there are, you know, an infinite quantity of these characters. In the game, at any given point, you're interacting with a couple dozen of these. And they're ranked. There's a hierarchy of them. There are like war chiefs and different levels of enemies. So some of them are really valuable and really difficult. Some of them are low level and you kill them easily. So there's a whole cast of these guys. And in addition to this, there's also a more traditional, conventional narrative arc. So you're still doing missions. They're still story-based. You know, episodes which are unfolding in the traditional fashion that you would expect. There's a conclusion to the game, and the story is pretty good. Personally, I have zero interest in Lord of the Rings. I don't care about the lore of Lord of the Rings. I didn't watch any of the Hobbit movies, but I really enjoyed the game. The story is good, but what's really, really cool about the game is the Nemesis system. And I felt like I could pretty much play the entire game and just interact with these artificial intelligence characters and have that be a really satisfying game by itself. How about you? What do you think? When you think of artificial intelligence in games, are there any examples that are really stand out to you?
You know, I really came unprepared with a great example. I can just say one that I appreciated recently.
Yeah.
Is in The Forest.
Oh, sure. That's a good example.
So in The Forest, you encounter these cannibals, and at first they're just scary.
For anyone who's unfamiliar, explain what The Forest is.
It's a open world survival game with a story arc. So unlike a lot of other survival games, it can end. It's
it's like a plane crash on a tropical island.
Yeah, you crash on this island and you were traveling with this little boy who you see him get taken away by scary cannibals. And then you're kind of like looking for him and uncovering secrets about the island. And so as you encounter these cannibals, you start to realize that they have individual personalities that are dynamic. So you might encounter a group of them and you kill one of them. And it turns out that the other one is like his life partner. And she starts crying and trying to drag his body away from you. And maybe she calls to her friends for help. And they just kind of have these like relatable group dynamics to these otherwise unrelatable like half-human cannibal enemies.
Yeah, that's a good example. I remember playing The Forest, I think, with you online and seeing these unexpected reaction from these characters. It's really kind of emotionally troubling in some situations, kind of like you described. Like, you feel like you're being attacked, and so you have a weapon. It's a video game. You know, you're kind of there to like defend, stand your ground, kill people as you do in video games. And so you do. And then, you know, a bystander who's one of these sort of tribal villagers, whoever he is, begins crying or runs away scared and shrieks. And you're like, oh, did I just do something wrong? Was I not supposed to do that? Because games generally sort of propagate the idea that you're supposed to kill the bad guys and you're glorified for doing that, and you get points and you get money and you get experience, and everything is sort of reinforcing this idea of, you know, perpetuating violence. And in the forest, sometimes it does do that, but other times it feels like, hey, maybe I'm the bad guy. And not knowing which of those outcomes is going to come is pretty interesting.
Yeah. And not to give any spoilers, because the forest has a great story, but maybe I'm the bad guy is a really important theme in the forest that continues.
Interesting. Yeah, I never even got to the end. But I remember, you know, the villagers kind of come to your camp at night or at day or whatever. They come in groups, and you can't communicate with them, so you don't really know what's going on. It's like, are they here to attack me? Are they here to communicate? Like, what's really happening? The feeling of not knowing what the context of the relationship is in the forest makes it a really unique game. And I think the artificial intelligence is one of the biggest contributors to convincingly creating that effect. You can't really predict how the people who approach you are going to act, can you? I mean, I didn't play the game more than 10 hours, but I felt like when people show up, you never really know.
Yeah, I remember the first time we got approached, it was scary. It was night. We had this fire in the middle of the woods. We didn't know where we were, and we just saw these kind of like something moving outside in the dark. And then they'd run up, and it's a person, and they're not attacking you. They're just kind of in your face looking at you and acting all skittish.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think we attacked first.
Sure.
I wonder if you could play that game and they're actually nice people if you just don't hit them with a rock.
Well, you know, I just figured like we have a spear or we have a rock or whatever. Like, let's go get them. You know what I mean? Like, this is kind of how games always work. It's like, I'm here to wreck things.
Yeah. Like, I'm the good guy, but you have a couple minutes in and I'm eating people to survive.
That's a great game to check out. For anyone who hasn't played The Forest, that's a fantastic game to check out. I think it left early access last year in 2018. Is that correct? It's a complete game now?
Right. And they released a VR version, which I'm really excited about.
That would be pretty spooky. It's a very creepy game.
Okay. So I had some notes that I wanted to kind of walk through some of the things I learned about AI.
Yeah.
Making Carrier Commander. And a lot of this is just, it's available online, but I wanted to kind of relate my experience in applying it to programming. I made Carrier Commander in GameMaker, which is not the most sophisticated engine in the world, but it does have a coding language that's, you know, capable of just about what every scripting language is.
GML, is it?
GML.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing I wanted to talk about was kind of the overall architecture of your AI. And there are two, not necessarily distinct, but two separate things, which is push and pull. So a push AI is, if you can imagine, one central entity making all of the decisions for smaller entities. So this is typically what you would encounter in a strategy game like StarCraft.
Mm-hmm.
So in StarCraft, you don't want every single Zergling to have a mind of its own, obviously. You need one AI to kind of see the big picture and make strategic decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's push AI. And the way that you would write that is you would create a controller entity or object, which then interacts with all of the smaller entities by sending them commands, maybe changing their state, depends on the game. And then the opposite of push AI is pull AI. So now imagine each entity in the game has its own AI. This is what you'll usually encounter in games like Halo, first-person shooters, games where the characters may not be, you know, enacting a master strategy, but just reacting to their environment around them in a simulated, realistic fashion.
Yeah, you know, Halo apparently is a really notable example when you look at game AI. It's one which is cited in the video game artificial intelligence article on Wikipedia. Another one which I noticed, which is an interesting inclusion, is the game Fear. Do you ever play that?
I haven't played Fear.
It's a really good game. It's a first-person shooter game, which is sort of a horror setting. It's a little bit like you're going inside like a CIA building and it's sort of haunted or something. There's some supernatural kind of stuff going on. And the game is credited with being a very influential, innovative artificial intelligence, which includes a lot of context-sensitive behaviors for NPCs, especially enemies who are like gun-toting, you know, SWAT-type characters. are doing dynamic things like cleverly navigating the environment, finding cover behind tables, which they kick over. They tip over bookshelves. They open doors. They go through windows. They act in all sorts of unpredictable ways and manipulate the environment. And apparently, this use of artificial intelligence and like environmental manipulation has been very influential, and a lot of games feature these types of mechanics now.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
In a lot of games, I remember like a lot of old shooting games, maybe Halo was one to a lesser effect, but they used to include a lot of enemies who would just turn a corner and just wait to be shot. You know, you just kind of point your crosshairs at a corridor, and it's like people just stream out, and you're just like shooting one after the other because they all act in such a predictable fashion.
That's like my memory of Doom.
Yeah.
Right? Just monsters coming right at you.
Right, right. So it's interesting to see that now it's become pretty much commonplace for enemy artificial intelligence in first person or even third person shooter games to respond to the environment in this way. Another one which is similar is BioShock. Mm. If you've played that, it's a fantastic first person shooter, which also includes a lot of really interesting dynamic NPC AI.
Yeah, one of the innovations of the Halo AI was the group dynamics of the enemies, which is a function of pool AI, which means each enemy has its own kind of individual AI controlling it.
Like cover fire and things like that?
Well, like maybe you'd encounter a squadron of enemies and there's a commander. And if you kill the commander, then all the other ones flee.
Oh, yeah.
Or maybe, you know, the opposite. Maybe you kill one of them and they get enraged. And they have this group dynamic where they react not only to you, the player, but also to each other. Which is really interesting.
I think in that game, you can also hear them sort of communicating and signaling to each other in some other language. So you may be in some sort of environment and you hear people calling something and they're sort of assembling into different formations to try to take cover, to attack you, and intelligently cooperating.
This was over a decade ago, but I'm pretty sure I remember they would call out when they were throwing grenades at you.
Yeah.
You'd know.
Right.
So that's push versus pull. And of course, these can be combined. To go back to the StarCraft example, there's one push entity controlling all of the enemy players. But when a Zergling gets within attacking range of you, it has its own pull AI that tells it to attack what's right within its little range, right?
Oh.
So obviously these two can be combined. The next thing I wanted to talk about was feeding information to your game AI. What does your AI use to perceive? So probably the biggest difference between game AI and real AI is that within the play space of a game, the game AI has access to 100% of the information if you let it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas real AI, they might strap a camera and, you know, a microphone, and it now has to interpret all of the sensory data from the environment around it. A game AI is nothing like that. You might try to simulate that effect to simulate a player, but the truth is that inside game AI, all of the information can be fed to the AI, and it's up to you as the developer to choose what to feed it and how to react to that information. So we talked about StarCraft. The StarCraft 1, the AI was cheating because obviously the fog of war didn't matter. It knew the location of every single unit that you have, and players maybe didn't like that. So StarCraft 2, they simulated perception like a player by not feeding the AI all the information.
Yeah, because I mean, in StarCraft 1, I don't know if you remember this, but I definitely do. I mean, if you're playing against the artificial intelligence, you're sort of building your base, you're getting your defenses, you're maybe 6-7 minutes into the game, all of a sudden there's a rush of Zerglings coming at you, and you're like, what the hell? How could they possibly know where I was?
Right, they didn't scout.
Exactly.
So, I mean, a simple way to program that out is just to make your AI send out scouts, and when the scout encounters a player, now the AI can see the player.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that's one example of like one small adjustment, which has a huge effect in the way artificial intelligence is perceived, or lack of it.
So, I mean, this can cover lots of different types of games. If you're making a first-person shooter, obviously you can't program all of your enemies to ray trace every single ray of light to see whether or not they saw the player. But you can do a very simple line of sight calculation by drawing a line between them and your player and seeing if it's obstructed. Is it really sight? Is the enemy player really seeing you in the game? No. It's just a very simple geometry calculation. Here's a line. Is there anything in between? But it simulates sight. And a lot of game AI works like that by just using basic equations to simulate player behavior.
What's the difference between ray tracing and just having geometric line of sight?
So
is there a difference? I mean, from a player perspective or from a development perspective?
From a development perspective, it would be huge because you'd have to, when you play a first-person shooter, you're rendering your view on the screen, right?
Right.
But all the other enemies are not rendering their view.
Mm-hmm.
So that would take a lot of graphical overhead to do. So you can shed a lot of that by just doing a real simple line of sight. Whereas sometimes they have to do ray tracing in first-person shooters in order to calculate cover fire. I was reading about that recently.
Oh, sure.
So if an enemy wants to hide behind an object, it needs some kind of concept of what does the player see? What do I see? How does this object obstruct the vision?
Right.
And all the senses can be simulated through kind of basic functions. So you see a lot of games, stealth games, that use like they have audio. If your footsteps are too loud, if you shoot a gun, you know, you alert all the nearby players.
Sure.
Obviously, they're not hearing it. You send out a ping and you say, here's a radius from the player that if anybody is within that radius, they heard it, right? And that's a simple way to simulate hearing. And you can do that with smell by leaving little tracing entities behind a player. It's probably all the senses you could do. I don't think you could do taste.
Yeah, maybe in some other planet with non-carbon based life forms where the enemies can feel you coming, smell you coming. who knows?
So the next thing I want to talk about, good segue actually, is the finite state machines.
Yeah, I have no idea what that even is.
So if you have a game, and I think stealth games are probably the best example of this, although in a lot of modern games, finite state machines are used to give more of a dynamic reaction to your enemies. So an enemy could be in a particular state. Let's rewind back to a Goomba in Mario, right? One state. The Goomba walks. When it bumps into something, it turns around.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's look at a more modern game, Broforce.
Yep.
In Broforce, all of the enemies are in the idle state until they first hear or see you. When they first hear or see you, they switch to an alert state. They get a little like red exclamation mark over them or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then they don't know your location at that time. So they've changed from idle state to alert state. And in alert state, they're walking around, they're looking. If in the alert state, the enemy is able to pinpoint your player location through line of sight, then it switches to attack state. So now the player or the enemy is attacking you. And it sometimes the enemy will go to a fleeing state. So maybe you shoot him a few times and that enemy switches state to fleeing. So then it runs away and maybe it forgets about you and it goes back to idle state. You see these in a lot of these games. So this is a finite state machine.
Mm-hmm.
That enemy has essentially, you know, four or five different little AIs that it switches between.
Right.
Based on its mood.
Mm-hmm. And the mood is influenced by player input.
And you can make really dynamic personalities in games by not only using finite state machines to capture different moods of your enemies, but you can also make your individual enemies different from each other. So maybe one enemy is braver and less likely to flee. Maybe one enemy has super hearing.
Right.
So those are some great ways to simulate realistic behavior for your AI enemies.
Fascinating. You know, I mean, as we get further into these details of AI architecture, push and pull, finite states, et cetera, it seems more like all of this is sort of an illusion for artificial intelligence, which we talked about at the beginning of this conversation. I wonder how far we are from transitioning from video game artificial intelligence in these sort of paradigms into a state of actual learning.
Hmm.
Maybe far away. Maybe it's not even a relevant question since, you know, something like finite states creates a perfectly satisfying gameplay experience, which is the whole point of this.
In terms of, development resources and also processing overhead, obviously simulating intelligence instead of actually using artificial intelligence is going to be way more efficient to create fun for the player.
Sure.
So I think we're pretty far off.
Yeah, it would seem we are. I think there's only a handful of games that are actually conducting artificial intelligence in the most pure sense, and those are generally online competitive multiplayer games. StarCraft II is probably one of those, maybe League of Legends, things like that.
So
so what else is on your list?
Yeah, the next thing I wanted to talk about was adaptive AI. This is where we're getting a little bit closer to real AI. So in adaptive AI, the computer needs to learn from the player, or at least it needs to simulate learning in a realistic fashion. You will often see adaptive AI utilized in fighting games because... Here's an example. You're playing a fighting game and you unleash a combo, right? And it works. And then if it works, then you could just unleash that combo endlessly to the end of the game and win, right?
Yeah.
That would be no fun.
Right.
So what they do in a lot of fighting games is it's very simple, but the computer will detect if you are repeating the same actions over and over, and it will adapt. And so the second or third time you try to throw this combo, it's going to block it, right? So now you have to shift your strategy as a player, which makes the game fun and dynamic, and it simulates playing against a real player who you couldn't just do the same combo over and over again unless you are cheap.
Yeah, no one likes that.
So to program adaptive AI, it's pretty complex, but basically what you do is you start recording the player's actions. And if you can record the actions and identify sequences, repeated sequences, then after the second or third time, if the player takes step one and step two, then you can predict step three, right?
Right.
So adaptive AI is based on sequencing and storing players' previous behaviors to adapt later in the game.
Right.
Oh, I wanted to talk a little bit about pathfinding. It's not quite AI, but it definitely has to do with controlling your enemies.
Oh, yeah. I have an interesting pathfinding quip to offer as well.
What's that?
So have you ever played this game called The Witness? Have you ever heard of it? It's developed by Jonathan Blow, who's the creator of Braid.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Yeah, so he's one of the most prominent independent game developers of all time. Braid is widely considered to be one of the top 10 independent games of all time. And he took, I think, 5 years to make a sequel to it, which is called The Witness, which is a first-person sort of puzzle strategy game where you're on an island and you're unlocking all these puzzles to traverse the island landscape. And this game was cited by Gamasutra. I'm sure you probably read Gamasutra a lot.
Yeah.
It's a really popular game development blog. It has just thousands of great articles on all aspects of game development, including artificial intelligence. One of the interesting articles, which I landed upon, which I'll link to in the show notes, is titled Seven Examples of Game Artificial Intelligence That Every Developer Should Study. And one of the examples on this really stood out to me. Most of them were about the sort of things that we've been talking about so far. Push and pull mechanics, finite states, adaptive AI, things like that. Basically mechanical functions of enemy NPCs inside games. And one of them was sort of a stark contrast to that. And it was artificial intelligence, or rather a set of algorithms, which was made to test walkability in the game. So it's a little bit like pathfinding in that in The Witness, what you're doing is you're in a first-person perspective navigating this island or a series of islands. And what Jonathan Blow wanted to do was to create a smooth and unobtrusive walking experience on the island to make sure that players couldn't get stuck on any objects or trapped in any walls, things like that. So he tasked a programmer named Casey Muratori to improve the player movement code. And so what he did was he created a set of algorithms which replaced the player and explored the entire island. And as it walked, created nodes and displayed lines atop the game map, which connected all these, created a network of movement which the player can conduct on the island. And white lines meant walkable, red meant not walkable, and it could basically explore every possible dimension of travel on the island, and it could identify any kind of movement issues on the island, like let's say getting stuck in a door frame or getting stuck on a tree or things like that. And so the development team could quickly identify problems with the movement code or with the level geometry, and then they could refine or improve that code. And they basically automated that process by creating this AI.
You know, using nodes is an incredibly powerful way to make simple AI perform the tasks of what appears to be complex AI. So I'll give you an example, right? Let's say you have a shooting game, and when you shoot the walls, there's bullet holes.
Mm-hmm.
A bullet hole in a game is a texture. It's not an object with its own code. It's just a little picture that's applied on the surface of another object.
Mm-hmm.
So bullet holes have very little processing overhead because they don't need to be processed beyond creation. So let's say you have an enemy who heard some shots and he walks into a room and you want him to be able to look, are there bullet holes or no? And maybe there's 50 bullet holes on the wall, but you are not going to be able to teach your enemy to visually identify bullet holes.
Right.
I mean, that's the really complex algorithm. So what you do, a simple way of doing that, is if there's some bullet holes in a room, you just create one invisible node in the room. It's just like an object with no image. The player doesn't know it's there, but there.
Hmm.
And then whenever the enemy character gets within a certain radius of this node, it flips a trigger, and now the enemy is alert and saw the bullet holes, even though he didn't really see the bullet holes.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, as a player, you're playing the game and you're thinking, oh, he's a person, he has eyes, he can see, bullet holes are on the wall. Obviously, from a programmatic sense, none of that is happening, since you all have to simulate to create this basically grand illusion through using techniques like that. That's interesting to hear.
Yeah, so nodes are really powerful, and you could do a lot with that. Back to pathfinding. So I wanted to skip the basics because there's a lot out there. But some of the stuff I had to deal with in Carrier Commander, and you might have to deal with in your game, is group movement is a big deal. Because if you have pathfinding and you have five guys and they're all right next to each other and you tell them to walk to a certain place, as a computer, they're going to have no concept of the group dynamic between them, right? They're all going to walk straight there. So you'll have them either bumping into each other or kind of like walking in this really like inorganic fashion, not like a group would. So you have to program in group dynamics. And there's a couple different ways to do that. One of them is you can assign a team captain. And I believe this is what StarCraft does, StarCraft 2 maybe. So if you assign a group of units to go somewhere, one unit will take the pathfinding mission, and all of the other units will simply follow that unit. And that creates a kind of organic movement.
Mm.
That's the team captain method. One of the methods I had to use in my game is a formation. Because in my game, you're deploying aircraft that need to fly in this kind of triangle formation.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to do that, I mean, all these aircraft have to have a concept of what planes are right next to them and where they should be in this formation. It's actually pretty complex because the formation is moving and turning.
Right.
So in my game, what I did was I created a node. You draw a path, and then the node just goes along your path. It's an invisible node. And each aircraft knows exactly the distance and angle that it should be from that node. So as the node travels along the path, each aircraft tries to be in its spot. And in that way, I was able to simulate realistic formation movement pathfinding just using a simple algorithm of a node and like a cosine function.
Interesting. Are there any resources or repositories for AI frameworks or bits of AI code that you could integrate into GameMaker? I know that there's a large community of GameMaker creators. Are they doing things like sharing artificial intelligence code bases or snippets, things like that?
I mean, within the GameMaker community, GameMaker has built-in pathfinding. That's pretty useful. There's a lot of people publishing kind of like their tutorials and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The most common thing you see is the finite state machines.
Right.
A lot of people are publishing those. I haven't seen anything really more advanced. I would like to see if anybody else has done the kind of decision grid map that I built for my game in GameMaker.
Hmm. What else you got on your list? Anything?
We have exhausted my list.
Great. So yeah, now that you are, the game is already published on iOS and it's in beta in Google Play. So the AI, I mean, the game is pretty much already done, right? You're just doing bug fixing on Android. Is there anything in the future coming up with artificial intelligence in Carrier Commander, or is that pretty much wrapped up?
I am releasing a big update pretty soon. but I haven't really adjusted the AI. I'm actually really satisfied by the AI in my game. You know, as a player, as a developer and playtester, I've obviously played the game 1,000 times, and I'm always delighted that it still surprises me. It makes moves that I don't expect. You know, like, I wrote all that code. How is the computer outsmarting me sometimes? I'm actually really satisfied with how it turned out. So I won't be updating that. I do have some updates coming out. I am switching the game to a free-to-play model, which I believe we'll probably discuss in an upcoming podcast.
Oh, wow. Cool. That's a big change.
Yeah, from the premium to the free-to-play model, we can compare kind of the results and downloads and things like that.
Yeah.
Since I bring that up, I should probably mention that every player who purchased the game as a premium game gets the in-app unlock game free.
Sure.
And that in-app purchase of unlocking the game is it's more than what the premium cost is now. So anyone who's already got my game is getting a good deal, because everyone else in the future, even though they download the game for free, in order to unlock the full version, is going to have to pay like twice as much.
Yeah, there you go. That sounds like fun. Cool. When do you think that's going to be coming out?
Well, I'm supposed to wrap it up this week. So maybe the week after that. This is the end of February. So probably early March.
Nice. All right. A lot of people in the CGF group have already been playing Carrier Commander. A number of people have already finished it. Some people have finished it on hard. I think some people have finished it with like 100%, 100% completion on hard.
Like, the players have gone way beyond what I ever did or thought anyone would do. Completionists, right? They go and they get every star. And they'll message me and be like, this one's not possible. And I'll just say, well, I didn't even think anyone would try that. It's just like, I didn't think everyone, they try to get every star.
That's pretty much an ideal outcome, right? That's funny that you didn't think of that, but they're like, look, yeah. they're scrutinizing it more deeply than you did.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the combined man hours of all your players is like exponentially more than any amount of testing you as an individual could put into your game.
That makes a lot of sense. That's really fascinating to hear, though, still. Do you have any kind of figures on that, like the total playtime across all platforms? Is that information available?
Unfortunately, no. I don't do any tracking in the game. My game's 100% offline, so I don't really keep up with what the players are doing. I just get feedback, emails.
That's respectable. That must be a huge number, though. And actually, in our recent podcast, which we recorded, you talked about spending, I think, 2,000 hours developing Carrier Commander just in Game Maker.
Right. And the players that beat it, from what I could tell, they spend about 4 or 5 hours to beat like easy mode.
That's a nice length. That's a hearty length for a mobile game, I'll say. That's a good length. Anyway, thank you for joining me for this podcast. I was really looking forward to getting into sort of the weeds, as it were, on the subject of artificial intelligence. This is an area which I don't know much about. Right from the beginning of this podcast, the Pac-Man anecdote I thought was really fascinating and simple, a great way to explain some of the dynamics which are at play here in this subject of conversation. I hope this was informative for listeners. If you guys are interested in learning more about Carrier Commander, you can find it on the iOS App Store or on Google Play just by searching for it. You can also listen to previous podcasts where we go into greater depth on the development of the game itself, if you're interested in learning about other areas of that project. Thank you for joining me. Anything else to add? You want to plug your website real quick?
FromGameToBrain.com.
Great.